When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So far from home, where I lay my head down by the sea.
Hey everybody, today's guest is Jason DeVore, lead vocalist for the Mesa, Arizona punk rock band Authority Zero. Together we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind their fan favorite hit, One More Minute, taken from their 2002 debut album, A Passage in Time. Jason and I go way back over 20 years, and it's always great to catch up with him. I mentioned to him that it's so cool that One More Minute is one of the band's biggest songs to date, given that it's from their very first album. A lot of bands take a second to find their footing, but such was not the case here. Jason said the song was about half written when one of his bandmates booked a string of shows just over the border in Mexico, where the song truly came alive. The track sounds awesome, in no small part to producer Dave Jordan, who has worked with heavyweights such as the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Social Distortion, and Talking Heads. Jason said that working with Dave was one of the coolest experiences he's ever had, and it was an amazing learning experience for everybody in the band. So for all this and a discussion on how to best treat ringworm, don't touch that dial.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Jason DeVore, what's going on?
What's up, Chris? How are you doing, man?
Doing well. I got to thinking this morning before we were set to talk that I've known you for like 20 years.
It's been 20 years, man. I can't even believe it, honestly. The thing is funnier, even so more so, is that I've known you even longer, but just as a musician.
Right.
And so, I mean, it's pretty wild, the history and the trip that this has all been, man, to be honest with you.
Well, and it's crazy, too, because I went back, of course, I researched these episodes, but you know, you guys formed in 94.
We did.
But you didn't release your debut record till 2002. And that's interesting because that gave you, you know, about 7 or 8 years to be out. I'm sure you were just doing the backyard party circuit, and then you started playing the bars and the clubs, and it went from there. Interesting, though. Was there any, I'm sure there was demos or things before that, but did you release anything prior to the major label record?
We did, yeah. Like you say, we were super young when we started. I was 14 years old when this band got together. We decided to try and figure something out and do something, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of those aspiring kids and the dream of it all. But it was kind of just a random idea to even do it. I was more into skateboarding than I was into, I mean, music came with skateboarding. My goal was to be a pro skater when I grew up. That was like my dream to do that. And so punk rock music and things like that all came with that. And when my buddy Bill asked me to be a singer in the band, I was like, and start a band, I was like, yeah, sure, whatever, no big deal. So we did that. And from there, like you said, we just started playing a bunch of house parties. Really, the reason it took a long time, too, on top of it, was we were just learning how to play instruments, how to sing, what we're even doing, you know, like what even we sounded like as a band, which was really nothing. We were just kind of all across the board, and it was like elements of funk, grunge back then even, you know, like some Stone Temple Pilots, some Nirvana, stuff like that. So, again, like you said, we were playing the house party surrogates. We did all the demo tapes. We did all that. We, you know, remember recording them ourselves and putting the labels on top of them and just passing them out to wherever we could get a chance to pass them out at schools and, you know, making all the homemade flyers at Kinko's, you know, shit like that. So it was really a lot of that going on. So we had, you know, the demo CD, we did a thing called Live Your Life, which was our very first album, if you want to call it that. We borrowed $2,000 from our guitar player, Bill Marks's mom and dad, and went to, what's a studio called in Mesa? Blue something, but we went in there for 2 days straight, recorded like 8 songs, did all the vocals like the second day kind of thing, and put that out. And then we went from there to do a Patches in Time, which was fragments of what would soon be our full-length album, A Passage in Time, in 2001. And that would contrived about probably about six songs, maybe, all of which were on the actual album that came out. So we did that locally here again with a radio DJ buddy of ours, Craven Moorhead, Derek Seidensticker, and just put that out. And it started getting some cool play on the radio locally because he worked with the radio station here, The Edge. You probably know The Edge from back in the day.
Sure, yeah.
He did the Scott Punk Show, which I'm sure you also know. Every Sunday, he'd do a one band locally called the Backyard Bollocks. And I went down there time and again, just dropping the CD off to him over and again, calling him. And he finally played it, and he was kind of into it. And then we became buddies, and he passed it on to the higher ups at the real station. And then they started spinning one of our better recording songs that he did. And that's when things kind of started really coming to life as a band for us into the next level of things, I guess.
Well, thanks for giving me that rundown, because I was going to ask you how that transpired, because it's kind of interesting to me here, because I look back, you know, when I asked you about what song you think we should do, and a lot of times I don't leave that up to the guest. I'll, you know, Chris and I will research it, how many Spotify plays, you know, and sometimes you just go in just knowing this is the band's big song. I was really surprised, though, because, you know, your debut album, A Passage in Time, was released September 10, 2002 on Lava Records, which was a subsidiary of Atlantic, and I had completely forgotten you guys were a major label band. You always seemed like you were an indie band that got about as big as you could get on the indie level, you know.
Sure.
And how did you become to the attention of Atlantic? Was that due to that radio play and some of that?
Precisely, actually. Yeah, it was because when we recorded those songs again at my buddy Derek's house, it was the first debut of these new songs I'm talking about that showed the light of day, and they were just better written songs, well put together, better recordings. And again, he passed them on to our friend Nancy Stevens, who was the program director at The Edge 103.9, 106.3 back in the day, 100.3. And she really liked one of our songs called Sky's the Limit. And it was more of a punk rock, pop punk kind of song with more of a big open chorus, kind of like the drop halftime thing.
Go, go to the sky, deep on and try, those wonderful things.
And that got some love. They got a lot of love on the radio station, and people were calling in and like, who's this new band? What's going on with these guys? And from there, we released a song called One More Minute, which is the exact polar opposite sonically as a song. It's more of a reggae kind of rock kind of vibe thing, which is interesting for us because we don't have a whole lot of that in our grand scheme of things. But it was the one that we started playing, and that got a lot of attention. And so much attention that, again, we got consistent airplay that just kept on growing and growing here locally. And then obviously, you know, record labels, they have the charts they look at, like to keep an eye on things, what's the next big thing or whatever the case.
Sure.
They saw our name popping up that's not a signed band that's getting ass loads of radio play locally, but just in this one town. And so they're like, well, what is this band all about? So they got interest. They contacted our management. They wanted to fly out and see us perform. So they did, and right around then is when crowds started coming out because of the radio play a lot more than just the small underground punk club shows, you know. And so this was a whole new world for us, and it was all happening so fast.
Yeah, and it had to be so exciting. I mean, I look back, you know, our first two records, if we didn't play anything from them now, no one's really going to care. There was just such this evolution. And I guess you guys did that before you got the deal, because, you know, I can't even imagine if someone told me to come break down a song, I wouldn't do anything off our first record. It's just so primitive and you know, just that those were our first, you know. But this track that we're going to talk about today, One More Minute, is, of course, from the Passage in Time album, which was... Jealous here, produced by Dave Jordan. Now, how was that?
It was a hell of a trip, man, because, you know, Jordan, he'd done the things with, like, Chili Peppers, Social Distortion, a lot of the greats that, you know, have come to be really successful, and in the vein of, you know, the punk, the funk, all of these elements that the band was really stoked on at the time, you know, especially. The thing with it was, back in those days, we were really excited to work with, you know, as coming up, obviously, the kids are into the Epitaph, the Fat Records, you know, the labels you strive to be on as a kid, listening to bands.
Oh, yeah.
Aspired to be like. So that was your shit. That was where you wanted to go.
Yeah, everybody did. And
so we threw all that producers that have done those records, too, at the label. And obviously, they were a major label, so they had different thoughts in mind. So they eyeballed different producers that were in our same blood vein that we might be super stoked on still, but not the guys we talked about so much, but people that had success with bands of those elements. So he came up, and I never heard of him personally at the time, but I came to learn a lot about him, obviously, throughout the recording process. And he's an interesting dude. He's a cool, cool cat. He's so laid back. He's like a Rolling Stone came into the studio and just sat down and just lit up a cigarette and didn't say anything, but made magic. It was a weird thing, dude. Like half the time you feel like you're producing the record with his engineer, even though he's like the guy that knows the things, and he'll chime in and do the moment of like, yes, that's magical, do that again kind of thing. But for a minute, you're just like in this ominous area. You're like, is that good? You know, and is there anything else you want to add? Because like you said, these are primitive songs that we wrote back when we were younger. I mean, like 15, 16, about girlfriends and like your old girlfriend from like 5 years before that you don't care about anymore. But I'm recording all these songs. I'm like, are we just that good? Because which is not the case, you know, but like, I'm like, is there anything I should do different here, Dave? So he was very picked his spots for where he wanted to make sure that you did things instead of overproducing what you already had and took what you had developed and made and your talent you did have at the time and just tried to make it shine and then brought his magic to areas that were really necessary.
Hey, look, I say this as a good thing, but most producers that are worth their weight in salt that I've met are a little weird.
Yeah, no doubt. They've dealt with all of us, man, for years.
Yeah. Well, for everyone listening to Dave Jordan, gosh, he's engineered and mixed records by Talking Heads, David Byrne, Frank Zappa, Mick Jagger, Rolling Stones, also produced and mixed for Fishbone, Anthrax, The Offspring, Meat Puppets, Social Distortion, and Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, that's kind of like an amalgamation of everything your band has done.
It's a big hodgepodge, yeah, and that's exactly what we super got stoked on the idea of him once we went through his catalog as such, like you say, and we're like, okay, this might be the right fit for this whole thing. And in the end, I think it was, you know, it became like a record that doesn't sound like any other record we've done since. It's got that timestamp on it, you know, and with his name and everything. And it's just got something very unique about it. Whatever he did in there, it was really special.
Yeah. And when you guys play this song, it's just the proof is there. The crowd goes nuts. It's one of your signature songs. But as you said, you know, this isn't indicative of you know, your complete sound. You guys kind of have a lot going on. And it's funny how the audience, your fans, you never know what's going to resonate and what's going to strike a chord.
Absolutely. No, very true. And it's interesting, too, because when the song came out on radio, it was like, it got, because of the local station here, it got a lot of love in Florida, just across the entire United States, which blew our minds. We were like, okay, what's going on? And so what was the big station out there? It was like
97X in Tampa.
97X Tampa, yes.
Yeah.
They started jamming the hell out of it for us, and we went out and played Extreme Fest, I think it was called, or 97X Fest or something.
Yeah, yeah.
With Blindside, and it was like one of our first times out there. And like suddenly we're this seemingly bigger band, and we're like, we don't know what to do with our hands, you know. And so we get on stage, and we played right after Blindside, who's a freaking slayer on stage from Sweden. So we're like, okay, this is crazy. What are we about to do with our reggae track here? You know, it's like, we got to really do something special to make it shine. And so they gave us a shout out, which is really nice of them, right before we hit the stage. So it kind of amped us all up. And we just went out and did our thing. And I think people were expecting, again, more of just a reggae kind of band or something. And we came out just leaping off speakers like as high as the stage and like,
yeah,
right in your face, you know, half the time weren't even on stage. And so they were kind of like, what the hell is this? And then we played the song, and of course I got the most love, and they were like, there it is, you know. And from there, you know, you see throughout the years, you know, radio trickles, of course, and you throughout the years you find your core fans, you know, that are in for the run of all the stuff you're doing, and they're really appreciative of the wide array of different sounds you're just excited about as a band, and it's cool how it's led to this many years of, you know, those same fans and their kids now, which is crazy too.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, and I became aware of you guys around this time, you know, because I was living in Tampa back in 2002. Yeah. So this song was on the radio off the debut record, which is awesome. Since then, you know, you guys around that time started landing things like the Warped Tour. And I was here seeing your name out there playing those shows with you. Of course, we got to tour together in Japan in 2007. Absolute blast. One of the best times from what I remember of it.
Dude, yeah, you gave me do you remember you chiropracted me in the back green room area?
Of course.
That was magical.
Yeah. It was my back hurt. I just flew for 16 hours. Yeah, me too. Ow.
Let me hook you up.
Well, you guys have released 7 more albums since the debut, the latest being Ali Ali Oxen Free in 2021. And take us back now. Do you remember writing One More Minute? And was it specifically for this record, or had this been in demo form kicking around?
I specifically remember writing this song more than probably any song I've ever written because of the fact that it is so diverse and away from my wheelhouse of like what I was into at the time. Because basically I was the punk rock kid, the punk skater kid, I guess, in the group. We had Bill, who was more the funk kind of blues guy on the guitar. Jeremy, my bass player, who was more into Megadeth, Metallica, Type O Negative. And then my drummer, Jim, who was like into thrash, core crust punk, and like hip hop. So that was like, Bill thought of this reggae kind of track thing. And I was like, I don't know, dude, that's not it. You know, I'm like, I'm not feeling this. I don't know. What do you want me to do with this thing? It's like, it's not fast. I can't skate to it. And I was like, if I can't skate to it, it's not a good song kind of thing back in the day. And so I just got creative with it. And we went to Mexico because we live right across the border down by Rocky Point, you know. And so that's where our first out of state touring happened. Was my guitar player, Bill Marks, was fluent in Spanish, going to school and college for it at the time, studied abroad in Spain. And so he's like, just really good at Spanish. So he lined up some gigs at the Viña del Mar down in Rocky Point for us. And it was like 2 weeks. A plane, we got paid in free rooms, booze, and food, like meals, 3 meals a day.
Yeah.
And so, but we had to play 3 times a day too. So we were like the house band playing our own stuff that nobody knew. So, yeah.
But at that age, sign me up, right?
Totally sign me up. Like, we made it. You know, we fucking made it. We're stoked.
Yeah.
So we're down there playing these jams and just getting trashed and having a blast, you know, spring break time stuff. And down there was when that song came to life for me lyrically, because we had such a good time for like 2 weeks straight, basically. And we were supposed to go home that one day. Everyone had gone home from Rocky Point. The place was clearing out, all the tourists and stuff. And we were laying on the beach out by the reef, wrecked at the reef. And we bought a case of beer at Pacifico's, and which is specific to that song. And yeah. We're already pretty lit up, you know, from just hanging out in the morning, the rollover kind of thing. And so we were sipping on Pacifico's that morning, and I'm making sand angels in the sand and all this fun stuff. And just like, you know, it's like, I just want to stay for one more minute. It's like, let's just stay for one more minute, have one more beer, and then we'll cruise back. We'll go back to our shitty jobs and our lives and like not this awesome we just experienced, you know? And so right there, it kind of clicked. And it was one of those weird, like, okay, that's kind of interesting. So basically that trip, when I was making those angels in the sand, I ended up getting ringworm. Because so there's a magical moment in the song where I'm like, from a long day of making angels in the sand, Pacifico in my hand, you know, and people think it's so glorious, angels in the sand, ring around my arm from a long day. He probably got sunburned from a beautiful day on the beach. And I just got freaking ringworm from like being a fool and like sloshing around in some dirty ass sand. So, threw some jacket spray on that and it went away in a couple of days. But that led to a whole storyline of just experience of what we just experienced down there. And it was a combination of like during the time we started going out to San Diego, which was also just, you know, around the border area. And so it's combined of like the beaches of San Diego, the beaches of Mexico. And it was just the best times of our lives. And it was like the all-encompassing idea of like, I don't want to leave this feeling. I don't want to, you know, go back to this other grind of the 9 to 5. I want to be in this band. I want to be in a band, and this is what I want to do, and just hold on to that for one more minute, and then we had to go back to work. And so that's where that song stemmed from.
Yeah, I love it. I love when inspiration hits and you don't know when it's going to hit. And if anyone were to tell you, if they got in their career where, you know, your band and my band has, you know, 20 plus years of doing this, yeah. And if they told you that they never thought about what you exactly just said of, I want to do this, you know, I don't want this to end. I'm standing on top of the Capitol Records building in Hollywood. I got our first album in hand going, I don't want this to go away.
Don't leave me, please. Stay here forever.
Yeah.
This is what I'm made for, kind of thing.
If the train leaves the track, just make sure I'm on it. Well, I want to jump into the song, Jason. We're going to do the single version here, which is interesting. I typically will pick the album version. The album version goes on for about another 2.5 minutes from this, about 2 minutes from the single version. And it really, you know, to break all of that down would have been, I just didn't feel it was needed. I felt like the single version is the song. That's the one that that I'm familiar with. It's 4 minutes and 27 seconds, a 16-bar intro, the first 8 bars. It's just your vocal and a flamenco-sounding guitar. Like, I think sounds like nylon strings on there. And there's like a crackling of a vinyl record running just underneath the music there. The vocal has that old radio quality to it, a bit distant and distorted.
Going back to where I came from, so far away but not so far from home, where I lay my head down by the sea. Going back to where we go, far away, but not so far from home,
where I'd rest, where I'd lay so peacefully.
You remember this intro? Was it like this on the demo? Was this kind of how you had seen it?
It was. It was the way we did it on the demo. It's kind of one of the oldest tricks in the book. I'm sure you probably know. It's like keep it quiet, then get the big explosion. Like here's the
song.
You know, bangarang, let's get dancing. So that was the concept behind that. Yes, we did that in the demo version as well, and then we really wanted to see that recreated. So we did the best we could to try and do that. And of course, at that point, you have demoitis, so you're like, it has to be exactly the same crackles. I mean, exactly that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Was that Dave Jordan's suggestion to do the record crackles, or was that something that was on the demo?
That was something on the demo. Yeah, we put that together ourselves in the prior one. So we were trying to get creative with that with the tools we had available at the time.
Have you ever been so high on something like that crackling? You're like, that makes the intro for me, and then you get it to a producer. He's like, why is that there? It's distracting me. And your bubbles burst. You're like, dude, that's my favorite part. So that obviously didn't happen here.
Yeah, no, we it's one of those things, like you say, you're so excited. That's like the part that must be in the song. And it's like, it makes the song or it doesn't make the song. And the producer tells you it does not need to be there. You're like, you're ruining my life right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, did Dave Jordan mix the record as well?
He did. Him and, oh gosh, what's her name? His engineer both mixed the record collaboratively.
Okay.
But mostly Dave Jordan did, yeah.
Well, I'm going to read these lyrics up to verse one. I'm calling this the intro, okay? We're not even into verse one. These are the intro lyrics, and I'll have you set these up for us if you can, Jason.
Sure thing.
I'm going back to where I came from, so far away, but not so far from home, where I lay my head down by the sea. I'm going back to where we'd go, so far away, but not so far away from home, where I'd rest, where I'd lay so peacefully.
Yes. So that all pretty much is, you know, that's me laying on the beach. That's me laying on the beach right there, just kind of going through my brain, staring at the sky, you know, just soaking it all in. And it's kind of a double meaning right there. It's like so far away, but not so far from home. Meaning, of course, it's like just across the border from the Mesa, Arizona, where we lived, into Mexico there, and as well as San Diego, but also your heart, where your heart is at, you know, so far away, but not so far from home, being your home, being the heart, where your heart is at. So that's kind of what that means right there, the whole intro piece.
Well, on the line where I lay my head down by the sea, right after that, we get a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's a tap on the ride cymbal bell, then one bass note and a light cymbal hit, followed by two more bass notes that are changing with the guitar chords. On the last line where I'd rest, where I'd lay so peacefully, three more bass guitar hits with light cymbal crashes. The bass is a little more playful here than the previous three notes above, and the cymbals ring out with that vinyl record sound as we go into verse one. And again, this whole intro is just your vocal and that guitar till those bass notes come in, and it has that crackle thing there. So you really are setting the mood here, as you said. It's, you know, you kind of want the next part to pop, which it does.
Absolutely, yeah. That's become the part that the crowd sings, which is, I think, what was the idea in mind with making it its own, almost its own little song of its own kind of thing and its own hook before the whole thing came into play, you know. So it worked.
Sure. And that's why I called it the intro. Typically, I'd feel like, yeah, that's verse one. But no, now we're in verse one.
But by the way, I want to break. We put this dress aside. But above all things, I want to lay by the other side. The ocean waves, no other way. Either way. But I'm finding, oh no, my daily worries want to drift away. Fine, dying and trying just to find some sort of peace of mind. Now's the time. Get away.
But, by the way, I want to break and I want to put this stress aside. But above all things, I want to lay by the ocean side. The ocean waves, no other way, get away. Well, I'm finding. Oh no, my daily worries want to drift away. Fine, dying and trying to define some sort of peace of mind. Now the time to get away. Did I get all those right?
So define is actually, wait.
Is that to find?
To find some sort of peace of mind, yeah.
On the Google lyrics, it says to find. It does say that, and I swear you say to define, and I even had my producer, Chris, listen to it 5 times. He goes, yeah, it's definitely to define. So Google was right, Jason. They rarely are, but they were right this instance.
Dying and trying to define some sort of peace of mind.
Yeah, dying and trying to find some sort of peace of mind because of the crazy chaos of your daily life again and all of that. And But by the way, so I'll go to that because that's the catchphrase.
I want to talk about that line. That's not something you would typically say in English that I've ever heard. By the way, was that an accident? Was that supposed to be like that?
So that was me trying to be, again, creative, like, you know, just think of something that's going to be catchy. So with songs, I've always been like a big hook guy, a big chorus guy or whatever. It's always my favorite thing. And I'll write verses around that because my thoughts were always, as long as you had your hook and you had your chorus that people could sing along to kind of thing in unison and in a grand scale, then the rest would kind of fall together with the storyline kind of thing. So, but by the way, was really just me trying to be creative and think of something that might be weird and quirky and just kind of set the tone to take you on that ride.
I've done that before, and I've had producers, and I go, that sounds weird, and like, no, that's got some vibe to it. It's cool, and it makes people think. So you never know what someone's going to say about something, but man, that is... It is strange, but it is hooky at the same time.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was a weird little thing. And I was like, this might work. We'll see what happens. It might be just, again, a confusing statement that people are like, what the hell is he even saying there?
Yeah. No, I think it's cool. That line, but by the way, the vocal is by itself there. Then the band is in with drums, bass. There's a guitar pan left that's a bit more playful. The guitar pan off right is more staccato, kind of stabby sounding. On the line, third line, but above all things, I want to lay by the ocean side. We get our first harmonies in the song. But the harmonies are really subtle in this whole tune until we get to the bridge later. And it's like the lights come on and we'll get there. One of my favorite parts of the song. But the harmonies here, they're very subtle. They're not super forward. I love where they lay there, but they're also not a strict harmony. You got some unison in there. How was that? And is that you singing the backing harmonies?
That was, yeah. I did all the backing vocals on the song. A lot of the songs I did, unless it was like more of the big chorus, like chant stuff, you know what I mean? A lot of the guys in the group at the time weren't big singers, you know? Jeremy would sing quite a lot more of harmony-wise live. Bill, my guitar player, had more parts actually specific for himself. But so, yes, on this song, it was myself doing the harmonies. And that was kind of the idea, too, is to let it kind of tear, you know, the song, because it is such a long song, like you say. You couldn't blow it all out at one time, basically, you know. So I was, like, really trying to be careful and pick my spots and the beginning phases of it to help each verse grow with the rest of the song with the storyline. So yeah, just kind of would try things, really. Just be like, just let it roll again. Let's try this thing.
That's great. And, you know, for the longer version, the album version, it's perfect for live because this song could go on as long as you want it to. You can have the moment and then hit that last chorus and the place goes nuts again.
Yeah, man, you got an hour and a half set. That's half your set right there, bro.
Exactly. Well, you get a harmony as well on the next line, the ocean waves, no other way, get away. It's subtle again. The hi-hat work here is awesome in this section.
Yeah.
After Well I'm Finding, there's a flutter of like acoustic guitars panned off left. It's super awesome. It almost sounds a little bit like timpani drums. It gave me that vibe and I kept listening, but I don't think it's timpanis. It isn't. Are those acoustics like super chorused and like with reverb on them over to the left? It's a really neat effect.
So that's a Jordan right there. That's a Jordanism because he got so wild with the guitars on this record in general. He was like, we did like seven layers of guitars that were all different sounds. Like he just loved different guitar sounds in general. I think
it reminded me of Jane's Addiction. Okay. You right before you'd get into a pre-chorus or something, you'd have that, you know, he'd have Navarro's guitars out there doing something weird. And I got that vibe from that part. It's really neat.
Yeah. It's cool. It's cool. Like you say, things like that, you'll really see the Jordan come out in on those are sections like that. I was kind of discussing earlier that, when it's really a moment where he feels really particular about and strongly about, he'll step in there and really make that shine and be strong about that opinion on it, you know? So we didn't know. We thought it was too many guitars ourselves at the time. I remember very vividly thinking that. And Bill's like, what am I doing?
You start getting confused when you work with a real producer. They're like,
you do?
keep doing it. Like, why am I singing this again? And then you realize that, oh, my vocals tripled in this bridge. You know, they're a mad scientist. They have this wacky thing going on. And like you said, your guitarist Bill's going, why am I doing these guitar? I played the acoustic guitar part 8 times. What's he doing? And he's over there, you know, scheming, you know, what this part's going to sound like. And it's not this huge, big part, but man, that flourish just makes it. It's so cool.
It does. It really takes it to another place, I think, just enough to where it like comes almost dry when that chorus hits. You know what I mean? That's kind of his magic he did there, I think, and really made that chorus pop. I think with making it muddier, waterier, affected-wise with the guitars, it really helped that whole element of the song.
I love certain emphasis and when a person, a performer's, when their personality comes across, and it really does here on the word fine, you kind of growl it. There's like an emphasis on that. And when that part came across and I listened to it over and over again, it got me thinking how funny it is when even great singers, you'll hear them do karaoke, but you know, they're trying to impersonate Rick Ocasek from the Cars or something. You can't impersonate that guy, you know?
Right.
And that's his personality. You can try, but you're never going to make it sound great. And it made me chuckle. I'm like, yeah, if I got up to try to karaoke this song, I could get through it. But when I got to the fine line, I couldn't try to emulate that. I get laughed out of the building.
Now, that's funny, because I was going to allude to that, because it did make it to karaoke, which my mom always said. She's like, once you make once you're on karaoke, honey, you know you made it.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, thanks, Mom, because she loves karaoke. But dude, yeah, even like, so even the song that they do on the karaoke, they do the recording with the guy singing it and showing you how to do it. Same great example right there. It's funny to hear like the emulation or the attempt to emulate that little moments like that, I guess, with anybody, but this specifically, it's like a yum, yum.
Yeah, it's like, where'd the pirate come from all of a sudden?
Yeah. The re-recording is pretty funny.
Come on and shout it out. Whoa, give me something true worth singing.
Hey, don't go anywhere. We got lots more coming up with Jason DeVore after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lambgoat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lambgoat's Van Flip Podcast.
Hey everybody, Chris Fafalius here. I know that you've heard us talk about the After Party Podcast, which is our weekly bonus episode that's a lot of fun. We get into a lot of music history, discussions about music in general, dive into things from the main episode, explore classic albums, etc. We've got a back catalog that's about 150 episodes strong now, and a new episode comes out every Monday. All you got to do is head over to ChrisDeMakes.com to sign up, and you get instant access to a new episode of the After Party each week, plus that enormous back catalog that'll keep you laughing and learning for a long time. Chris talks a mean game about his metal knowledge, so I recently tested his wits with a whole episode of Headbangers Ball Trivia. Here's a little clip from that one. Okay, you got 1 point going into question number 4. What was the first music video ever played on the Headbangers Ball?
I don't know the answer to this.
You need a multiple choice?
Multiple choice.
A, Dokken Dream Warriors. B, Poison, Talk Dirty to Me. C, Cinderella, Somebody Save Me. Or D, Judas Priest, Another Thing Coming.
No idea.
You know the answer? You can play along to plenty of trivia episodes in the back catalog right now by heading to ChrisDeMakes.com and signing up for the supporting cast. And hey, members of the supporting cast might even get a chance to take Chris on in an episode of Defeat DeMakes as well. I promise it's coming back soon. Thanks so much to everyone who has already joined. And if you're heading to ChrisDeMakes.com to sign up right now, a big thanks to you as well. It's your support that keeps Chris DeMakes a Podcast alive and kicking. And now, back to the show.
And I'll tell you, this next part is awesome. What's going on here guitar-wise in pre-chorus one? It sounds, Jason, like it's a 12-string acoustic or a heavily chorused 12-string clean guitar is strummed off to the left, while a funky guitar with kind of like a wah pedal, maybe a tremolo, is panned off to the right. Is that a 12-string over there?
He did a 12-string on that, as well as a regular acoustic and the clean tone guitar as well. So that's a combination.
Awesome.
Of all those things right there, yeah.
It's so different. This pre-chorus doesn't sound like anything else in the song because of those 12 strings.
Yeah, it's almost like the pre-chorus is the biggest parts of a lot of the song, really, to, you know, they give a lot of that shine and openness to it, I guess, breath.
Right. I'm going away. Oh yeah. No other place to go. I wanna got to get away. Let's get away. Oh, away.
Yeah. It's just like, let's just go back to that place. Basically, you already kind of, in your mind, I was already, you know, imagining having to get back to the daily grind kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure a lot of these, I'm thinking back, it was, like you say, so many years ago, but a lot of that was finished up once upon returning back home, away from the bliss of all the magic that had just occurred, and daydreaming of it, I guess, in some regards, during that time frame, that I think that really helped put all the pieces back together to make it all come to life with the storyline of it.
Okay, and I was going to ask, were the lyrics pretty much done, or were you still kind of figuring things out in the studio, like, hey, I don't know if this line works? Do you remember any of that happening?
A lot of it was, yeah, was done, because we did, like I said, we did that pre-demo. So in that regard, I think a lot of it was written in that demo, or the Patches in Time version, in studio, with just, I'm like, yeah, and just like kind of spitballing with my buddy Derek back and forth, like, which one's better, this one or this one kind of thing, you know? And so I think a lot of it was really pretty well put together, but a lot of the fine line tuning was really done in that first demo making of it.
The bass is just amazing in this pre-chorus section. Just, yeah. It's just ripping. On a way, the vocals ring out over that tremolo guitar panned off to the right, and we get that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 snare hit into chorus one.
One more minute, the beach is sending. One more minute, yeah.
You know, this part, it doesn't sound like the Chili Peppers, but it reminds me, and of course, Jordan worked with them too. It sounds like two different people here. The one more minute is this gruff, kind of like, you know, you're kind of going, harking back to that when you say fine. It's got this, you know, really, really throaty, growly one more minute. And then the beach is San Diego. The next line is mellow. It sounds like two different people there.
Sure.
One more minute. The beach is San Diego. One more minute. Yeah. One more minute. The beach is Mexico. One more minute. Yeah. One more minute. We kick it back poolside. One more minute. We're down by the ocean side. One more minute. One more minute, one more minute.
That's it, man. Just one more minute. And that's all. That's all it was about right there. You say, it's just, I wanted to hold on to that as long as you could, you know? And with the voicings of it, that was something, just once again, trying to be a little creative with doing something different. Cause again, we knew how long the song was, and I was like, I gotta really do something special to make this pop and differentiate it from all these long verses that I'm already kind of pulling out a lot of tricks on. So with that, I've always had a kind of a relationship with vocally with getting compared to James Hetfield of Metallica a little bit because of that growl.
That is in here a little bit too, and I am guilty of that. I had to really strive to get away from that. My first Less Than Jake record, I'd get the Hetfield thing going because he was my biggest influence as a singer growing up.
Dude, yeah.
And sure. That I had to be cognizant of that. I didn't want too much of that. You could still hear it a little bit. You know, I kind of have his same tonality of where his voice sits. But it's funny you bring that up. Is there double unison vocals on One More Minute? Sounds like there's one or at least one or two of you there.
Might be four, dude. Honestly, yeah. on that recording, we tried to beef that up so super much and then really soften the blow on the response. So, yeah.
Well, the drums, bass, and stereo guitars here, stereo guitars left and right, playing upstrokes, but pushing and pulling one another. They're not lined up completely. And I've noticed that in a lot of, if you want to call it, reggae rock tracks that I've been listening to, they'll do that a lot. And I really want to start doing that. I've always had stereo images of Less Than Jake because we only have one guitar player, but it's really neat to kind of have them playing off each other a little bit. I like what's going on there. The drum fills are really the only busy thing in the chorus. The chorus is pretty mellow. You're just kind of hanging on that vocal. We get a harmony on We're Down by the Ocean Side. And then after you say One More Minute three times, we're right into verse two.
So far away, down the other peak, I want to clear my head and make it in the warm sunshine. Want to be living life's edge. I will wait, the horizon straight away, and a ring around my arm from a long day of making angels in the sand.
So far away. And here's the line, I don't know, it says, and sandy on the beach, I want to clear my head and break it in the warm sunshine. What do you say there?
And Dowdy on the beach.
Okay, I saw Dowdy, D-O-W-D-Y. I saw that on some lyric site. Is that a place you were at?
No, Dowdy's just like, it's a term of like just rest, relaxation, things of that nature.
It's an English word?
An English word, yeah. I'm okay. Pretty sure, like, actually when I was a kid, when I was back then, I was looking for some other creative word, so I think I looked that word up.
Dowdy.
Dowdy,
okay.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm doubting myself, Dowdy. It's Dowdy, D-O-W-D-Y.
Yeah, okay. Dowdy. That was a moment I was like, I need to get, a sharper word here to get it a little bit more, like, make you think, make you, like, dig into it a little deeper.
I'd like to think of myself as a pretty good linguist of the English language, but you got me here. I've never heard Dowdy. That's you learned something on our show, folks. Who knew?
I love it. Check it out, folks. It probably doesn't mean anything that I just explained either.
Okay. Well, once again, so far away and Dowdy on the beach. I want to clear my head and break it in the warm sunshine. Want to relay relaxation with the horizon break away and a ring around my arm from a long day of making angels in the sand.
Yeah, getting ringworm.
Do you ever seen that live, getting ringworm in the sand?
I don't. I need to start, though. I tell that story live sometimes, too, though. It's like, podcast specific sometimes or interviews, because it is just a funny moment to me that it sounds so glorified and like glamorous that of a line, because it's got this pretty flow to it, you know?
Yeah. But I got ringworm about 10 years ago, and I went to the doctor. I was freaking out, and I'm like,
yeah,
I think this is ringworm. And the doctor's like, yeah. And I'm like, what did I do? Like, am I dirty? I'm like, he's like, dude, you got ringworm. Like, grow up. Like, put some whatever, like tenactin on it or something. You'll be fine. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, it's like I went too, and I was like freaking out. I thought I burned myself because I was just, And it turned out it was ringworm, and I was like, had like a little ring right here on the front of the arm, and then I had a line down by my arm a little further. And I was like, something's wrong. And so, like I say, I went to the doctor, and he's like, it's just like jock itch on your arm. Go ahead and put some cream on it. You'll be fine in a couple of days.
Awesome.
Making the song sound killer, right?
Yeah, maybe you're immune now. You know, your system's built up an immunity to it.
Yeah.
I love what goes on here in verse two. It's like the first half is so different from the second half. On the first half, it's drums, bass, and a new guitar. A new sound here coming in, panned off left, playing a lick that sounds like a hollow body guitar with lots of room on it. Almost sounds like a pre-delay on that guitar panned off right. My eyes were kind of ping-ponging back and forth during this part. It's really neat.
Sure. Yeah. Dave Durden, again, that's the magic of him. He had, in his studio out there in Burbank, he has this giant, really high-ceiling room that he recorded a lot of those acoustic guitars in. And so he captured a lot of that big room live sound with miking and certain techniques that he did. And he did it. He really did. He did such a great job of capturing those elements that you're hearing right there and make them stand out on top of that amidst the chaos of all the guitars, just acoustic, basically.
I think it's great. Well, on the back half, the guitar goes back to the feel of verse one. It's really cool. We get harmonies on Want to Clear My Head and Break It in the Warm Sunshine. Want to Relay Relaxation. Then the next line is really cool. I never knew this was the term for it. Roger told me recently, Roger from Less Than Jake, he said, oh yeah, those are feature words. And I guess that probably comes from rap, because rappers do this a lot. And on the word with here, there's a few vocals stacked just on with to emphasize that word. Yeah, they call them emphasis words to be featured. It's on that. And you also hear a harmony on Breakaway there on the last line of Making Angels in the Sand. That big drum fill again takes us into pre-chorus two. There's a new lyric here on line one only, Pacifico in my hand. Oh, yeah. No other place to go. I want to get away. Let's get away. Oh, away. Pre-chorus two, you got that one line that's different. You wanted to tie that in with laying in the sand, but the rest of it's the same. Was there ever the thought of, hey, we should keep going here and expound a little bit more, or did you want it to be like that? Interesting.
Did kind of want it to be like that. Yeah, change it up a little bit. Just keep it interesting again. And that was, and even with the drum lines, like we tapped into those for a second. You mentioned the drum lines and the big fills. A lot of that was with this song is because we were not a reggae band or any really from too much of that element, I guess. We wanted to make it as non-reggae sounding as possible and do something just different. So it gave it more of a swing beat to like not make it just your standard kind of thing. And that's where a lot of that busyness came from, as well as the bass guitar. I think those elements really made that move and make it interesting enough to where it could be a longer song like that. But leading up to that pre-chorus there again, just also keeping it interesting by adding just little flavors here and there to keep it rolling and not get stagnant.
Okay, now by the time you guys recorded this in 2001, this was done to Pro Tools?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Pre-chorus two, at the end, when you say away, the vocals ring out again, and that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's those six snare hits. Those sound a bit louder here, like they have more room on them. They sound bigger, and I A-beat it like 10 times. Did you ever notice that? And producers will do that. They're like, hey, the song's building. We're going to give it another dB or two here to give it a little more oomph.
Yeah, I did not specifically hear that myself, but I wouldn't put it past Jordan to be like just thinking that the whole time that, again, things have got to keep building.
Can you get him on the phone right now? We need to ask. We need to clear this up, Jason.
I want to call Jordan. He's probably between the B12 shots. He was known for that, like having his guy come and give him the B12 shots in the studio. That kind of stands out in my mind.
He had his own needle person to give him his own dude?
I'm telling you, homie, he would like come in, he'd sit down in a chair, like, what's up, in his leather jacket, hair spiked up.
Give me my coffee and my B12, and I'll tell you what's good.
Yeah, he's good to go, man. He's like jazzed back up, and he's back behind the board just going to work. But what was I going to say? Oh, that's the magic, again, of Dave Jordan. Just like the cool thing about it is, like you say, with producers a lot of times, a song like this should have been cut in half or would have been cut in half by so many producers and been like, this does not need to be here. This is fat. Trim it. And he, luckily enough, weirdly enough, saw the potential of keeping a six-minute song, and 6 minute plus, I guess, and just wanting to work with it and take the clay and mold it into something that could be possible.
Well, and I love when producers let the band sometimes be the band.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure Atlantic, okay, because, you know, this song was the fifth song on the album out of 13. So all of a sudden they're listening through going, well, this is the single, but we can't release a 6.5 minute single to radio. So now you're in another predicament.
See, you know, even the radio edit, they're like, this is still 4.5 minutes long.
Yeah.
How are we supposed to sell this or, you know, convince people that, okay, to play.
And the bands that were getting 4.5 minute songs on the radio then, they were established artists like the Chili Peppers, you know? Okay, right. It's the Peppers. This song's good enough. We can let it go on for 4.5 minutes. But not everyone got that opportunity.
Exactly.
Pre-chorus two, same instrumentation as pre-chorus one. Coming out of the away part with that snare hit, we get into chorus two.
One more minute.
The beach is ending.
One more minute.
Same instrumentation and lyrics as chorus one. We get that same harmony back down on We're Down by the Ocean Side. And then we get into the bridge. And man, this is where the lights come on for me in the track, because the harmonies are now just hitting you right between the eyes. You're now going for it. You're like singing some high harmonies. They're not subtle here.
The sunshine in my eyes and the flamenco.
Sunshine in my eyes and the flamenco in the skies. The only way you'll ever know is to go.
That's it. Yeah. And that's a big part of it right there. You say is that it was essentially, to me, that was kind of a verse three. And it was like, but I knew I was so wordy storytelling throughout the entirety of the song, almost like it got more wordy as things went on. And so I thought I'd do the opposite of try and get extra wordy and thinking, and sometimes that'd be the way to go with it to make it build. And do the exact opposite and just pick key phrases that all encompass the entire image I was trying to paint the picture for, I guess. And I think it did that. And I think it's with that in mind, with the big harmonies, it sounds like sunshine almost like came out from behind the clouds.
It does. I said it made me feel like the lights came on. Not like the song was dull, but all of a sudden you're in this other world. And that's what a bridge a lot of times is supposed to do. We get harmonies on every line here. Was that your idea or Dave's or a combination of both that I really want to go up here? I want to hit some higher notes and have these harmonies really front and center.
That was my idea. I did, like I said, I did want to see it take another turn and make that, as I say, number three thing before the next chorus really take on a life of its own. And I thought that that might be a way to really help it go there. And I think there's like even, man, I think some of them are the hidden like kind of ghost harmonies in there. But I think I tried like six different variations. I'm typically a high guy, a low guy, and a middle guy to kind of get that rounded out thing. But I think with that one, I did like five or six different variations to try and make that a thing. But I think in the end, with Dave's production, I think that he felt it more so necessary only to make the two elements shine, the big high guy and then the main lead. And it was like the less is more kind of thing that really helped it pop a little bit there.
Yeah, there may be some stuff tucked way back, but I just hear the predominant, the lead and the harmony. Right after the line and the flamenco in the skies, there's this great little flamenco guitar part run after the line that comes in there.
Oh, in the sky,
it's perfect. You know, you hear that at the top of the song, you don't hear that tone again. And then all of a sudden it comes in after the lyric. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. Little salt and pepper seasoning kind of things. Like you say,
there you go. And on the line is to go. It's a great reverbed kind of echo that happens there that leads us into the 16 bar guitar solo panned very, very slight left. Halfway through, we get a here we go from Jason, and the chord progression here is the pre-chorus chord progression. We get an away, and that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 snare hit comes back in. That snare hit, those six hits, it's happened now, three or four times in the song. I talk about this a lot. That's a little hook within the tune. Was there ever thought of changing it up, or did you guys look at that as a hook? No, we're not going to, because you could do a number of different kind of fills and feels there.
Totally. No, we definitely saw that as a little earworm, I think, that was just, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of moment. You know, we're like, it's just kind of like the segue into the big part that's all going to be one piece that is consistent in the song for sure.
Well, we get one more chorus three here, same instrumentation. The lyrics don't change. And, you know, besides the one more minute, there's a lot of information here, you know, and a lot of times when choruses get wordy, you want to keep it the same. So by the third chorus, your audience or the listener is going to be able to digest it and remember it. Was that kind of the thought here? Was there ever like, hey, I could slip in another line about, walking down the beach and something else happened? Or was it always, you wanted to be the same three times?
Like you say, yeah, it was pretty much the repetition of that. I think I was just trying to drill into people's brains and make it the all-encompassed storyline of the song and just keep it pretty straight away.
One more minute. The beach is San Diego. One more minute.
The last thing you hear is Shed the Light. Is it four alls in a row, all day?
No, just Shed the Light all day. So it's like it repeats itself, and I think it's written out as like he does this like an absurd amount of times.
Well, on the single version and on the album version, at the very end, it's the same ending that happens here. So briefly, okay, after chorus three, it goes into the Shed the Light all day part, and it's kind of like an extended for lack of a better word, like a reggae, like a jam band. It just kind of goes on, and then you hit what would be the fourth chorus at the end. But when it does end, it's the same ending that's on the single version here. Shed the Light All Day, and that 12-string guitar comes back, panned off left with the bass and drums, ending on like a little cymbal crescendo, and the song comes to an end. Your first single from your debut album, and here you are talking about it 21 years later. That's pretty cool.
Pretty wild, man. And thanks for helping me discuss it, because I haven't really broken it down like that ever. So it's kind of fun to actually think that back through and really go through the process of it this many years, like you say, later, and be like, where was my head at in that point in time, and what did we actually do?
Have you played it at every show since you wrote it and recorded it?
We played it at a lot of shows throughout the year. Yeah, we played it almost every show because, like you say, it's the one that a lot of people do know. Even like the fans that have, you know, the band that have stuck around because it was the radio song single thing, they still appreciate it too. There's the fans that are like, I'll do anything but One More Minute because you have such, they'll say better songs than that one, you know, whatever. But there's that, obviously there's like half the crowd that still wants to hear it. We still love playing it, which is pretty wild this many years later. It's still, you see people's faces light up. You see the energy in the room go to a different level. So it's like, why not? You know, it's like, it's still relevant to daily life of, we still all go through those hardships of work, those daily problems and frustrations that you're dreaming of that at your desk daily, I'm sure, many times.
I stopped being artsy and for the sake of being artsy many years ago, you know, there'd be times where like, we're not playing Johnny Quest tonight. And inevitably you'd be at the merch booth. And the first guy that comes up, he's like, you guys were great, but why didn't you play?
Like, totally. You're like,
okay, I'm going to fix this. We're just going to play it. And that's going to be the end of it. And every time I go out and play songs like that we played every night and will continue to play every night, my appreciation for them stems from the fact of how hard the audience is going over. And now the fact that I can't believe I wrote this 30 years ago and someone wants to hear the darn thing.
Right in your garage. It blows your mind. You're like, this thing is still making sense to people. Like, wow. It blows your mind. It really does. So, you know, there's that element always of like, give the people that love you and your music what they want. Obviously do what you love to play, and you have to enjoy yourself because that transfers over and crosses over the energy. But, you know, there's songs like that that just, there's something that's also you get back from the audience from seeing the excitement, like you say, that they still have the appreciation for that song for it, and it makes you excited to play it again.
Absolutely. Well, I know you just got home not too long ago from a tour. You guys are out there all the time, still killing it. What's going on with Authority Zero? What do you got?
We just got off the East Coast leg of our Getting Old Sucks tour with Bowling for Soup, which we've done some stuff.
Yep.
And Mest as well, and we're heading back out in about 7 days to do the West Coast now. So we're going to finish that up for about 2.5 weeks. And then we've been slowly writing new music. We're not trying to force anything because that's what we thought we did pretty right with the last record was we took our time with it and wrote songs we really were happy with. So we're casually writing, but we're also working on a lot of new different elements of possibly another live acoustic album. Every two albums, we typically do a rhythm and blues album where we do like a live thing where we rewrite all of our songs from two albums and then do a live show and put that out. So that's probably in the works. New music, of course. I've got a solo record coming out in May, April. I'm not sure if that's relevant or not with the Authority stuff right now, but I started doing solo stuff about 2006. I started writing songs that were really not in the vein of Authority, as diverse as the band is and things like that. It just, songs I was like, this will not work at all. It's just going to be strange. So I started recording them, kind of just home studio stuff with my buddy Brian. And then before I knew it, I had one album and I was like, cool, I'll put it out. It's like very singer-songwriter kind of stuff. And, kind of started doing open mic night things with that to try and just see if people actually enjoyed the music like I did. From there, I did another album, then a third. And then I recently, well, 2 years ago now, between touring, started re-recording my song Courage. And I just wanted to make it a big, big anthematic song for like almost like theatrical, like, you know, big cinema kind of sound that I always wanted to hear, like Braveheart. And so I did that. And then I was like, well, I got these other songs now too that I had in my little notepad from like over the last 2 years of the COVID thing and like touring and just like whatever. I went and sort of sifted through and I was like, there's some good stuff here. I'm like, maybe I should start just trying to lay another song down. And so I did, but at Underdog Studios here in town. And before I knew it, I was recording a full length album and money was getting kind of short with that. So I was doing it very casually. And then in comes a label called Double Helix Records out of Scottsdale, Arizona, which they signed Yotam from Useless ID, M from Tsunami Bomb back in the day. All these things, like great artists that they, and they're an independent label here, a husband and wife, and Yodom introduced them to my solo stuff. So they're like, yeah, we've heard of Authority Zero. And they're like, no, we've heard of solo stuff. And they're like, no, we'll check it out. So they came out, and then they were interested in wanting to sign me and put a record out. And I was like, that's great. This hasn't happened in years, you know, since like Lava. So I was like, okay, how's this work now? And so super cool people, super supportive, like grassroots DIY kind of stuff, and just over the top supportive. So now they took over helping me produce this new record that's coming out and give me the studio time that I need to get it done to the way I want it put together and to the best of its ability. And they're going to help me release it in April, May. It's going to come out on Double Helix Records, and it's a combination of all three records I've done solo, as well as just because naturally I think some Authority Zero sounds and tinges are coming into play rather than just the acoustic singer-songwriter kind of thing. So there's horns on it, there's like, you know, trumpet, there's trombone, there's big drums, there's like, it's there's cello on it. There's a guy called the Punk Cellist that's online. He does a lot of
stuff. Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
But yeah, Ian the Punk Cellist. I found him online. And I was like, hey, do you know the band Authority Zero? I'd love to do a song with you, with our band. And it didn't come to work out, but I was like, well, now I'm doing a solo record. It would really use some cello on that.
That's
and
awesome.
So he's all over it, and it's really cool the way it's coming together, man. And it's being produced by Bob Hogue, myself, and Kristen, also out in Underdog Studios. So,
well, tell Bob Hogue I said hello. I haven't seen him in a hot minute.
I will, man. Yeah, I'll be seeing him in November to finish this thing up.
Awesome. Jason, thank you so much for sitting in. Tell the guys I said hello, and tell those clowns in Soup and Mest I said hi to.
I will, Chris. You do the same with your buds.
It's your courage. Take them on, take them out, take a stand, take them out. It's your courage. Take them on, take them out, take a stand, take them out. Whoa.
Hey, everybody. I know a lot of you were waiting for this episode with Jason DeVore for a long time, and I hope you enjoyed it. But don't go anywhere. There's lots more Chris to Makes a Podcast coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Chris to Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Finding Amelia, a Midwest alternative rock band with soaring guitar riffs, catchy melodies, and a wide variety of instrumentation. The track I'm about to preview features a 12-string guitar. Pretty cool in my book. Here's a snippet of that song, Paper Planes.
My heart, but still so.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, that was a fun one, Chris. Listeners have been requesting a Jason episode for a long time now. I swear it's once a week someone writes, have Jason DeVore on the podcast. And now I see why. The dude's a great storyteller and a great conversationalist. I love this episode.
No, me too. He's awesome. Known him forever. I said right at the top of the episode, over 20 years now, didn't mention that him and I, the last tour that I did late January of 2020 was with Jason. We did a 10-date acoustic tour with Howie from Ballyhoo and a couple other people out west. And, you know... being trapped in a van with people you don't know, you know, I kind of thought about it. It's going to be 10 days. It was 10 shows in a row, no days off. And I said, how's this going to go? And it couldn't have been better. It was just such a pleasure.
Nice. One thing I thought was pretty cool is when he was talking about Authority Zero. Every member of the band had different taste and influences. You don't usually see that much diversity of taste in a band. He's like, oh, this guy liked thrash metal. This guy liked funk. This guy, I'm like, wow, how did those people end up all playing together? It feels like the people you play with in a band are usually because you have similar tastes when you start your band. That's just, I haven't heard that really before. I mean, of course, everyone likes what they like within the band. You don't like exactly the same, but it sounded like they had a wide array of influences.
Yeah, I've heard stories like that where, you know, when they knew Hefe was a great guitar player, NoFX, but he came from the hip-hop world. He came from dance and electronica. You know, he never heard punk. He's like, what is this? You know, but he's a ripping guitar player and he can sing like nobody's business. So, hey, you're in the band. That happens sometimes. Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. And I've always said those are what makes a band is the sum of its parts.
I also thought it was cool hearing about Dave Jordan. Of course, you went through his resume in the episode. It's everybody from Talking Heads to Rolling Stones. It's just crazy what he's worked on. But I thought it was cool to hear how he was like a little bit eccentric. And, you know, how a lot of times with these old school producers, you'll hear that and I think that comes with the territory. If you are a visionary, someone that can, you know, really see music and take it to that next level, yeah, you're usually kind of a different person too.
I've said this a million times. A producer is a coach, a mentor, and a poor man's psychologist, psychiatrist. They're there to, the good ones are there to just kind of witness everything going down and they chime in when necessary. That's why I've never been a producer, because I'd be chiming in every 2 seconds. Yeah. And I would ruin the soup. Self-admittedly, I'm telling you right now, I just don't have that about me, to that restraint to sit back and go, we'll get to that part. It's not there yet, but this part's really great. Now, I'd want to talk about the bad part first.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm sure every producer has their own methods or whatever. But
sure.
Obviously, Dave Jordan is and has done something right. Hey, Chris, I also looked up the dictionary definition of dowdy.
Oh, you did? What is the Merriam-Webster definition?
In parentheses, it says, of a person or their clothes, unfashionable and without style in appearance, typically used of a woman. And the sample sentence they used was, she could achieve the kind of casual chic that made every other woman around her look dowdy. So it's a little different than Jason's use of dowdy.
I love the education I get here on Krista Makes a Podcast, and I had never heard of that word. Had you heard of that word?
When I read it back in that sentence, it sounds like something they would say on Downton Abbey or something. Like, it sounds like something from like centuries before. Oh, she looks a bit dowdy.
I kept seeing dowdy written on these lyric sites, and I'm like, who copied and pasted this from the last lyric site? There's no way this is the lyric. And sure enough, when he said that, I fell out of the chair.
Yeah, but I don't think this was a very dowdy episode. I thought it was great, and I think everyone who listens to it today will think the same.
Absolutely. No, this was a pleasure, and they're still out there kicking it. They're working incredibly hard, touring, doing their thing 20 years on. Good for them, and good for us, Chris, because
we're working hard. We're doing our thing too, you know, just like Authority Zero.
Exactly. ChrisDemakes.com. Head over there and sign up for our supporting cast, which again is like a Patreon, where you can get bonus episodes each week called The After Party, where Chris and I will talk your ear off even more than we already do. ChrisDemakes.com. Please head over there and support the podcast you know and we hope you love.
We got to do an episode where we just learn new words that we don't know. Would you want to do an After Party episode where we just learn a bunch of new words, new vocabulary words to use in our everyday
vernacular? That's the next one I want to do. I'm serious. Let's do it. And when we do it, I will tell you about the dictionary game. There's actually a dictionary game that's really cool that I used to play with my parents as a kid. Lots of fun. Man, this has been a blast. Give me and Chris both a tandem follow on Instagram. I'm at Less Than Chris D. He's at Chris Fafalius. And I want to thank this week's guest, my good friend, Jason DeVore, for being on the pod, and we'll see you next week.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.